5.
The Brussels court overturned the mayor's closure order. So there's hope for free speech yet, even in Brussels.
4.
You know, if you can't defend your opponent's right to free speech, then you cannot expect to have free speech yourself.
3.
Well, Iran's best friends are the Chinese and the Russians.
2.
You know how reluctant I am to stroke your already considerable ego, co-pilot.
1. We have liftoff.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast with Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. It's good to have you back, co-pilot, after Baroness Claire Fox did such a sterling job of standing in last week. And there's so much to discuss, including the Cass report, penned by paediatric physician Hilary Cass, which concluded so-called puberty blocker drugs can exacerbate gender dysphoria problems among young people while leading to long-term physical and mental harm. Already, this report has moved the dial when it comes to the fraught and sometimes baffling debate about gender and identity politics. Then there's the court judgment earlier this week relating to the Michaela School in Northwest London. A Muslim student and her mother lost their High Court challenge against a ban on prayer rituals imposed by the free school's founder and head teacher, Catherine Birbal Singh. You've interviewed former Prime Minister Liz Truss, who has a new book out for The Telegraph. Link to that piece in the show notes to this episode. But Planet Normal listeners are about to hear some of what Truss said that you didn't reveal in the newspaper write-up of your chats with her. And then there's Rishi Sunak's smoking ban, which has a long way to go before it gets through Parliament, but has already been rejected by a large share of the Prime Minister's own MPs. Beyond the UK, what does last weekend's unprecedented and shocking attack on Israel by Iran mean for the broader Middle East and the world? We'll be hearing from a British journalist who's lived and worked in Iran over many years. Plus, UK inflation in March was 3.2%, down from the previous month, but still stubbornly high. The resulting delay to interest rate cuts will hit the finances of millions and could also have a big political impact. But before we get to all that, Alison, let's consider what happened in Brussels earlier this week, when Belgian police, at the request of the Brussels mayor, attempted to shut down a political meeting full of elected politicians, with whom the same said mayor largely disagreed. What did you make of that?
Absolutely shocking, Liam. I mean, really quite hard to process it. It's so outrageous. In fact, many of these alleged threats to public security who were assembled in Brussels for this National Conservatism meeting were some good friends of Planet Normal. And I had gone to interview Liz Truss, as you mentioned, in London, end of last week, and bumped into Professor Matt Goodwin, a very good friend of Planet Normal. And Matt was enthusing about going to this NatCon conference in Brussels and telling me about what they were going to be discussing, strong borders, the immigration crisis, and all sorts of people, academics like Matt, Suella Braverman, Nigel Farage, Hungary's Viktor Orban, properly democratically elected leaders were at this conference, which had to change location 3 times because they were being cancelled wherever they were. And ironically, Liam, the conference was kicked off by a Polish MEP who had suffered censorship and brutality under communism. And he said, oh my God, you know, this is what they're doing to us. Even now, today, this socialist mayor of Brussels trying to clamp down on freedom of speech. I mean, the most egregious example of freedom of speech. And we were lucky enough, Liam, to hear from our friend Miriam Cates, Conservative MP, and Miriam was actually attending or trying to attend that conference when police were preventing delegates from getting out. So just before we started recording Planet Normal, I caught up with Miriam Cates and Miriam told us what happened.
So this is a National Conservatism Conference. It's a kind of gathering for people with conservative views who believe in strong nations and strong national identities and are coming together to discuss the kind of politics and philosophy of that. But when I was on the train over to Brussels yesterday, I became aware from the organisers, and it was all over Twitter, that the third venue that they'd managed to find for this conference was being in the process of being shut down by the local mayor in Brussels and his police force, because I think in the words of the mayor, he was worried about the dangerous views of these traditionalists and that the far right, he said, were not welcome. And so in the end, the police tried to make their way into the building, but realised there's not a lot they could do about it, but essentially prevented anyone else from coming in. So people could leave, but they couldn't come back in. And so when I got there, I had to be snuck in through the service entrance behind a bin to make sure that I could get in and deliver the speech, which was on protecting children and keeping children safe. So it was absolutely extraordinary to be in Brussels, which, of course, is the home, the capital of the European project, the whole purpose of which was supposed to be to protect democracy, which, of course, is founded on free speech and freedom of association. To have that kind of anti-liberal, authoritarian reaction to a bunch of conservatives getting together was just extraordinary. But I think what's even more worrying is the reaction of the left here in the UK, because we can criticise this one mayor who did a very illiberal thing and was put under huge pressure. But what disturbs me is that those on the left in this country have celebrated what happened. Now, of course, we all like to have a go at our political opponents, but the very foundation of liberal democracy is freedom of speech and freedom of association. If you are so frightened of what your opponents have to say that your only option is to shut them down, then it's really worrying. And the claims that the Belgian mayor used were absolutely spurious. You know, the idea of a threat to peace, there were going to be violent protests. I mean, it was absurd. There was no evidence of that whatsoever. You had a bunch of actually quite young, a lot of the people attendees there, European conservatives getting together to hear speeches on philosophy, politics, religion. You know, if you can't defend your opponents' right to free speech, then you cannot expect to have free speech yourself.
Finally, do you think that there was some inkling there that many of the people at the conference will have strong views? Suella Braverman was there, of course, Professor Matt Goodwin, that will have very strong views about the need for borders and lower immigration to protect the sort of cultures of different countries. Do you think, Miriam, that there's a sense of the European elite getting very, very worried that issues over borders and migration may herald a swing to the right?
Yes, I do think they're worried about a swing to the right. And obviously, those kind of conservative views are on the rise in Europe, and probably we'll see a number of conservatives elected at the elections this year. So yes, of course, they're worried. But I think what's really, really worrying is that they can't see that they are starting to employ the tactics that the EU itself was set up to avoid. So in a way, although obviously it was very frustrating yesterday for the organisers and very worrying, I think it's good that it happened and that it has been exposed. And I think that people can wake up and realise what happens if you start to crack down on free speech.
I must say, Alison, I think it's great that you spoke to Miriam Cates. And I'm also glad that Rishi Sunak has come out and condemned the Brussels mayor. It's very clear that free debate and exchange of views is vital, even when you disagree, said Rishi Sunak. And I also think it's interesting that on Wednesday, the day we're recording Planet Normal, the national conference has resumed because the Brussels court overturned the mayor's closure order. Yeah. So there's hope for free speech yet, even in Brussels.
Well, that's right, Liam, but I'm wondering, because I think that this intolerant authoritarian left are really not liking the pushback against gender ideology and against migration. We've already seen in Scotland the sort of absolute, you know, untethered madness of this dobbing people into the police for hate speech. Fortunately, that's now becoming a complete joke because they've had many thousands of complaints of hate speech. Two things to say for me here. One, Belgium does not have a problem with the far right. Belgium has a problem with Islamist extremism. It's an absolute hotbed and centre of European Islamist radicalism. So the Brussels mayor should be far more worried about clearing Brussels up from those people than persecuting perfectly legitimate, democratically elected people like Miriam and Suella Braverman. But Miriam's point, of course, was that we saw in the Commons Wes Streeting, of whom I would expect a lot better, chortling away, laughing in the House of Commons about the way a legitimate conservative conference had been shut down by police. And I agree with Miriam, that's absolutely chilling. And I'm worried that this is a harbinger of what we might see with a very, very large majority Labour government. And just to end, Liam, with Nigel Farage's words, he was furious as the conference being shut down.
He was on stage when the police arrived.
He was. And Nigel said, we are up against an evil ideology, a new form of communism. And of course, the NatCons got more publicity than they could have ever have dreamt of, didn't they, by being shut down.
Now, I want to come on to your interview with Liz Truss and her new book and so on. But just before we do, Alison, you talked about the pushback that's now happening against gender ideology.
Yeah.
And I think part of that pushback was the Cass report, wasn't it? Which Baroness Claire Fox and I discussed last week.
Yes.
But I know that you've got strong views on and you've written eloquently about it. But it's not just the Cass report. We've also had this court case relating to the Michaela School. Two very distinct episodes, both of which suggest that this whole debate about identity politics, cancel culture, and so on is maybe starting to shift.
Well, I hope so, Liam. I have felt that these are slivers of sanity in a very, very dark picture. Listeners will know that the Michaela School, we've spoken to Britain's strictest headmistress, Catherine Birbal Singh, remarkable woman. She and the school came under attack on account of a Muslim pupil and their family who were demanding a right to pray during the school day. Now, Planet Normal listeners may know that Catherine Birbal Singh has very definitely made Michaela a secular school. And that's very, very important because she understands in multicultural London that you have to find unity. So they even go as far as to have vegetarian lunch meals. And that's because they don't want anybody being left out. They just want everybody to have the same. And that is a very powerful message for someone like me, who has queried the way that multiculturalism so often has led to division. But hallelujah, what Catherine referred to as bullying identity politics, this case being brought against the school, apparently by a family that Catherine Birbal Singh didn't want Muslim pupils being able to pray during the school day because it was going to be sort of spearheading into all sorts of different things. It wasn't specifically about that. And just to prove that, Liam, the parents of this child in question have asked for their second child to attend the school, which they claim is discriminatory. So make of that what you will. But yes, so we've got these sort of two cases now in the last 2 weeks, which have very strongly, I think, marked what we hope is a turning point. And the Cass Review, as you say, it's really put the trans zealots on the back foot, Liam. I read the Cass Review, over 300 pages, in a quietly devastating way. This very rational, mild-mannered paediatrician has spiked their guns. Cass was damning about puberty blockers, unevidenced treatment for children, damning about the way that therapists, we've had James Esses on the programme, concerned parents, campaigners like Helen Joyce, they've been shut down, cancelled, lost their jobs. She was also very damning about the fact that at least six NHS gender care centres would not cooperate with her inquiry and failed to provide details of the thousands of young people who have transitioned and wouldn't let her know how they were getting on. So I thought that what came out for me from this was stuff that people like you and I have been saying, which is that there are multiple factors behind this huge surge, particularly in teenage girls thinking they're in the wrong bodies, a 4,000% increase, 4,000% increase in girls reporting unhappiness with their bodies. And Cass said that there were many factors to this which were not related to gender identity, autism spectrum, anxiety, depression, family problems, childhood trauma. And this is the thing that really shone out for me, Liam. Young girls being exposed to hardcore pornography, which makes their reluctance to become women all too clear why that is. And I personally believe that you can map on the rise in these so-called trans kids absolutely bang on to the rise of social media. Trans is a cult. It affects a very small number of people. It came to affect thousands of young people because it was being communicated to them as a lifestyle option via social media.
It's worth saying that Catherine Bebelsing appeared on Planet Normal back in August 2021, and James Esses, the barrister and psychotherapist you referred to, Alison, appeared a year later in August 2022. Listeners can look up those interviews on our archive. For me, what's interesting about the CAS report, and let's not think that this is a marginal issue, Alison, 9,000 children underwent
at least
potentially life-threatening, quotes, treatment at the NHS Tavistock Clinic alone, a clinic which has since been shut down, though people we know in the NHS tell us that a lot of the function of Tavistock Clinic has been dispersed to other places. And it is absolutely astonishing to me, as the CAS report revealed, that many NHS trusts, most of them that Hilary CAS approached, wouldn't actually cooperate with the report, wouldn't actually disclose information to her, even though she was a government-appointed person who was examining a taxpayer-funded organisation. Quite astonishing to me. And then I think there's the other point, CAS, just before we come on to Liz Truss, that the reaction to CAS has been very interesting, because it seems to be this report, because it is authoritative, because it is by a person who is seen to be credible, this report is now providing cover for a lot of people who have failed to speak out about these issues at all. It's been brave people who have spoken out, not least women, women like Kathleen Stock, like Rosie Duffield, Helen Joyce, Julie Bindle, you, Maya Forstadter. Many of these people have appeared on Planet Normal, and you've taken brickbats, you know, J.K. Rowling, for speaking out and highlighting these dangers, while so much of the political and media class has just sat there with their finger on their lips, letting everyone else take the heat and take the pain on this debate. But now that CAS has happened, it may be that a government report, unusually, actually serves a really important function, which is providing a fig leaf for, quote, the great and the good to change their mind on these issues and start pushing back against an extremely vociferous trans lobby that has bullied many of us into their point of view, or has tried to bully many of us. And in that sense, I do think it was worth returning to the CAS report this week for your take, because I do think it will go down historically as an important report.
Extremely. And let's hope, as we said at the top, let's hope this is a turning point. Talking about these shameless politicians, Liam, suddenly discovering that they thought this gender identity stuff was quite worrying all along. Listeners might like to look up an exchange in the Commons between Victoria Atkins, the health minister, where she suddenly takes to task this guy called Lloyd Russell Moyles, who is a Labour MP. And Victoria basically calls him out for his previous appalling behaviour in the Commons when he was intimidating two female colleagues who were standing up for the rights of children. And you may remember, Liam, that he moved around the house.
He crossed the floor, didn't he? So he could sit next to and intimidate female Conservative MPs who were trying to put forward in a democratically elected chamber the fears of themselves and their constituents. It's completely outrageous.
And before we're just going to move on shortly to Liz. I just want to say that we're really hoping to build on this now, making sure that children are protected going forward from this harmful ideology, which has actually wriggled its way into every area of society. So we've seen the Safe Schools Alliance and Family Education Trust, Liam, have written to the Prime Minister calling for a public inquiry into regulatory capture in the education sector and safeguarding failures in schools. I'm doing a lot of work on this now with our new Telegraph news desk and with other people. And if any Planet Normal listeners, your friends, your neighbours, have children or grandchildren who have received inappropriate sex education at school and have been introduced to these concepts, which Hilary CAS has really criticised, please do write in, because we're not going to let this drop now. We're not going to let children be told they're in the wrong body when they're age 7, because that is completely wicked.
That's encouraging, Alison, and best of luck with that work, which, of course, we'll be discussing in the weeks and months ahead on Planet Normal. So let's move on to the former Prime Minister, Liz Truss. She has written a book, 10 Years to Save the West. And I have to say, she's managed to make a bit of a media splash with it, hasn't she? Not least in The Telegraph.
She certainly has, Liam. I'm slightly reeling from it because Liz Truss is quite a divisive figure, as I'm finding out. Personally, I think she's rather brave, but I know lots of people think she's foolhardy and so on. I mean, I see her as having challenged the cowardly consensus, really. But it is an interesting book. And I did spend a couple of hours, and she was very, very generous with her time talking to me about what she felt had gone wrong. Overall, the book is positing this theory that liberals in the West have become too comfortable and complacent and are not taking our enemies seriously enough. And she makes some very strong points about that. You know her better than I do. It strikes me that one of the reasons I wanted to write a fair piece, okay, it wasn't an obsequious piece, it was a fair piece, giving her a fair hearing. And it strikes me that this, oh, Liz Truss crashed the economy, Liz Truss, you know, put my mortgage up. I just felt that that lacked nuance. I mean, she became an easy pantomime figure. In the last few days since the book came out, we've seen particularly male political commentators being horribly mocking and unpleasant, really unprofessional and disrespectful. She's the fall gal. You know, it's like real Punch and Judy stuff, and it makes me uncomfortable. But what do you think? Did Liz Truss crash the economy?
No, I think that is simplistic to the point of being disingenuous, albeit it is very convenient for her political adversaries, not just in the opposition parties, but within her own party,
yeah,
to hit her over the head with that particular stick. Look, I've written and spoken a lot about the mini budget. I do think parts of it were rash and tin-eared. I do think it was ill-advised to cut the OBR out of the process, even though I absolutely share a lot of Liz Truss's analysis about the overweening power now of the OBR, about the ideological direction of the OBR, which seems to have almost a veto over the government's ability to do what it wants to do what it's been elected to do, according to its own manifesto. And I think Liz Truss is exactly right, as she revealed in her interview with you, to want an inquiry into what happened in the run-up to the mini budget, not least because while she is to blame for some of it in terms of lacking communication skills and failing to prepare the ground for some of her policies, for being in too much of a hurry, it's also true that just days before the mini budget, the Bank of England started selling billions of pounds worth of government bonds, IOUs, back into the market, a kind of reversal of that ghastly quantitative easing program, at a time when it knew damn well that Liz Truss's mini budget would also require the selling of lots of government debt, i.e. more borrowing. And the Bank of England should have delayed that. And now they say, oh, but we didn't know what was in the budget. She should have told us what was in the budget. They knew what she was going to do because she talked about it endlessly during the leadership campaign. So I do think there are very serious questions for the Bank of England to answer. Almost every single mainstream economist disagrees with me on that. So let's have an inquiry and find out. And the reality is, Alison, that what happened in September 2022, while it was shocking for a few days, it was part of a much broader global trend of interest rates going up.
Yes.
And interest rates, you know, I'm looking at the 10-year government gilt yield now. That's not often a phrase you hear on Planet Normal. But so I'm looking at the government's cost of borrowing for 10 years, a cost which, of course, varies through time as and when the government wants to take on new borrowing. And the reality is that the gilt yield, which, of course, is the benchmark for mortgage rates and every other borrowing cost in the economy, spent large parts of 2023 above where it was at the height of the so-called mini budget panic. And then, of course, there's the whole saga of the so-called LDI investments, which I think I'll spare our listeners for now. But just to say that, again, there are questions there for the Bank of England and regulators to answer, because the Prime Minister, Liz Truss, was blindsided by this so-called LDI investment scandal. And so was I. And so was almost every economist that I know. So clearly, this is a danger which the regulator and or the Bank of England should have been highlighting?
Well, I got to pay tribute to you. You know how reluctant I am to stroke your already considerable ego, co-pilot. But I felt that I went into the Liz Truss interview extremely well prepared because you had taught me so brilliantly and clearly through all this various technical stuff. So I was able, I think, to engage her reasonably well. Now, the reason I have come to the conclusion that there is at least a smell, if not a stench, of stitch-up is both political and economic. Now, something Liz Truss told me, which didn't end up going into the interview, was about this Office for Budget Responsibility, right? So they basically, she's saying this unelected body is basically holding the reins of power. And an example that she gave me, Liam, was that they were not looking at GDP per capita. The OBR are just looking at GDP, doing the arithmetic based on the number of people coming into the country. And as far as they're concerned, the more that number goes up, the better. And that's the more leeway they're going to give a prime minister who wants to cut taxes.
Because they're arguing that more immigration leads to more growth, which leads to more government revenue, which leads to more scope for government spending.
That's exactly right. But the point that Liz Truss was making to me, she said to me, I was keen to bring legal migration down, but the OBR was saying to her and to the number 10 team that Suella Braverman, who was then the Home Secretary, is going around saying she wants to reduce immigration to 100,000 or 150,000. So we're going to score that against you, your plans. So Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng were saying to them, well, how much notional growth will you give us if we say we're starting fracking, which was their promise? Zero, right? Okay, so how many billions will you give us if we say we're going to have a major house building program? Zero. So what they are saying is, Liz said to me, she was gobsmacked that legal migration was 600,000. And she said to the OBR, it is ludicrous that you are scoring us on the rhetoric of Suella Braverman. You are not scoring on the actual numbers. And she says, people can criticize me, Alison, for many things, but I am pretty honest about what happened. So, Liam, you know this stuff inside out, but it strikes me that the OBR has this absolutely astonishing sway. And is this democracy? If a prime minister, if the vast majority of British people want immigration to come down and to come down fairly drastically, but an unelected financial body, advisory body, can tell the prime minister, we're going to take billions away from your spending potential or your tax cutting potential if you dare to bring immigration down. What is that, Liam?
Alison, this is a hugely complex topic, and anyone who really wants to know what I think in detail can just Google my name and Office for Budget Responsibility. But what I would say is this. George Osborne set up the OBR because for years, ministers had manipulated Treasury forecasts in order to give themselves political room for manoeuvre, which led to bad financial management. Having said that, we've now gone too far in the other direction. The OBR, the faceless, unelected, technocratic economists, who are often from a sort of centre-left background, not least because of the way the OBR seems to have been recruiting them, do have the whip hand over elected ministers. And there seems to be an ideological standoff now between elected conservatives who want to do certain things, like cutting corporation tax, which a lot of evidence suggests would actually raise the amount of revenue that you generate from corporation tax because it would generate more growth. And the OBR, on the other hand, who takes a very dirigist, dogmatic view of taxation and spending. I do think there is now a standoff between conservative politicians who may want to cut taxes in order to generate growth, and the OBR, on the other hand, who is really reluctant to recognize that tax cuts themselves may lead to more growth and more revenue. That is a view, that is an opinion, that is something which The historic evidence is mixed on that, though I would say the historic evidence is largely on the side of those who say that lower taxation leads to more growth. I mean, look at America, one of the least taxed economies in the Western world, and it's growing at 2.5%. And that's a trend that has held over many years, even decades. So I do think the OBR is ripe for reform, but I can't see that happening under Labour. So who's climbing aboard the rocket this week? Daniel Radd is a British journalist whose family left Iran back in the 1950s. A fluent speaker of Farsi, Daniel, who was raised in and lives in the UK, has spent extended periods of time in the Middle East, working as a journalist and international development specialist, not just in Iran, but across the broader region. A former correspondent for Financial Tribune in Tehran, Daniel Radd is now regional editorial director for the specialist news website BNE Intellinews. I've known Daniel for some time, having met him when I visited Iran back in 2015, a time of great hope, just as Iran and the West had signed a nuclear cooperation deal. That deal, of course, has long since been scrapped, and relations between Iran and the West, along with Iran and Israel, have soured badly, not least since last October's attack by Israel on Hamas. I started by asking Daniel Radd if he was surprised at last weekend's attack on Israel by Iran.
No, because this has been coming for the past few weeks. Iran, the embassy it has in Damascus, was hit by an alleged Israeli missile. Israel didn't claim that it hit them, but it took out the entire building and several senior Revolutionary Guard commanders with it. The Iranians promised a response and ultimately were egged on by certain hardline elements within the regime that said if they didn't do a response, you know, even the wider Iranian public was becoming increasingly critical of the regime's lack of response to the attack on Damascus, that they had to do something. However, the attack on Israel wasn't a surprise. They gave everybody, including the US, and I assume the Israelis by extension, 72 hours notice to say that they were doing so. And the flight tracking data across the region was cleared well in advance of the assortment of 350 rockets, drones that flew across Iraq and Syria before getting ultimately taken down with different anti-missile.
You are somebody who is very informed about Iran, but you're also culturally in many ways from the West. I'm just thinking how things have changed since we met in Tehran. I think it was back in 2014, 2015. Things have changed a lot since then, haven't they?
Yes. So you had the Obama nuclear deal, which the European Union countries, and the UK was one of them at that point, went along with as long as they could all have access to the markets. The Americans, who basically negotiated that deal, didn't get edgeway into the, you know, commercial bounty from an opening up Iran. So that ultimately led to the Republicans, led by Donald Trump, to pull out of the deal in 2018 and send Iran into a free fall of economic decline, which it's still falling from today.
So when we met in Tehran, Daniel, back in the day, the country was seen as some kind of really exciting emerging market, wasn't it? Ripe for Western investment. Of course, there's been waves of Western investment in Iran over many years. Since those days, Daniel, of course, President Rouhani's been replaced by President Ibrahim Raisi. But how else has domestic politics changed?
Yeah, so the country has become more hesitant to deal with the West. The hardliners were proved, in their mind, correct that dealing with the West and America was a fool's errand. And, you know, they warned from day one that America will go back on its end of the deal. And so they have effectively that side of the country taken over control of pretty much all aspects of administration of Iran, from the parliament, which has had a very poor turnout at recent parliamentary elections, to the presidency, who's tipped to be the next supreme leader if he gets his way, and to the judiciary, which has become increasingly hard. And again, recently stepped up efforts to try and deal with women who don't wear hijab. As 2022 reminds us, the Mahsa Amini protests, the country is preparing a counter move against another protest movement, by the looks of it.
How does it feel when you look at, you know, partly the country where you're from, and you see that women are being jailed for protesting when they want to take off the veil, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's disappointing. The economy over there is doing so poorly. The demographics are looking pretty weak. Emigration continues to bleed the country of its best people, and all look for different ways out, whether they're trying to cross the English Channel or get visas legally to Canada or Australia or wherever. The situation of the country has become incredibly bleak in recent years. And, you know, the currency has collapsed probably, you know, 80, 90% in the past year. The spending power of people has dropped. It's $110 a month for the average salary, for the average worker. The situation out there looks bleak, and especially, you know, both men and women, many are just looking for a way out.
What do you think the future is of relations between Iran and the West, and indeed Iran and Saudi? Because, you know, for non-students of the Middle East, unlike you, we need to remind ourselves that whereas Saudi is the biggest Sunni nation, Iran is the biggest Shia nation, and the two main parts of Islam don't always see eye to eye, do they?
No, indeed. And when you look at their relations over the past few years, the Iranians, you know, they talk about the sanctity of their embassy. They quickly forget that they've attacked several embassies in recent years, including the British embassy in 2011 when hordes of revolutionary students, as they called them at the time, climbed over the gate and the fences and wrecked the place and set fire to the visa office. Basically shutting down relations between the countries for several years, until last year when the Chinese brokered a deal secretly, and without, I think, the Western knowledge. This, they had no idea this was happening, between Riyadh and Tehran, where they would play nicely between each other. And in exchange, China would buy oil from both of them.
I have watched with real interest. We'll come back to Iranian-Western relations in a moment because, of course, they're uppermost in our listeners' minds. But I've watched with interest, not, I wouldn't say an Iranian-Saudi rapprochement, but they've certainly, some of their interests seems to have been more aligned in recent years, in particular as they've both developed really strong relations now with China.
That's right. And Saudi Arabia is looking for economic growth. They're looking to grow their economy. They're diversifying away from oil and gas. And, you know, they're investing in all these projects like the Line and NEOM and all to try and earn a few quid from it. The Iranians can't do any of that. So they've been locked into the traditional selling of oil and hydrocarbons across the Gulf. Between the two of them, Saudi Arabia is moving off into a, you know, a mass development situation. Iran is, you know, trucking along, doing the same thing it's been doing for the past 40 years.
Well, you write very authoritatively, Daniel, about the whole region, the whole of the Middle East. Clearly, uppermost in your mind is the Iranian-Western relationship. Where's that going?
Yeah, so the relations with the West are still weak. You know, I was just thinking about the embassy in Damascus, and I was there outside by complete coincidence when the British embassy was raided by the Revolutionary Guard. And, you know, relations have been poor for many, many, many years, and they don't seem to be improving. When you look at Iran's relation with America, it sends messages through the Swiss and the Omanis and the Qataris, but it doesn't really see a way forward with, you know, dealing with the West.
What could relations be? I mean, maybe it's churlish to speak about such a time of acute danger and conflict and outrage, but what could relations be like?
There could be a big change in relations if certain things were you know, agreed from their perspective. The Islamic Republic doesn't seem to be going anywhere fast. And, you know, that's one of the things that a lot of people always misjudge about that country. It doesn't appear to be on the brink of collapse in any way, shape or form. They have a growing security industry. They have, you know, as they've shown, they have rockets that they can lob towards Israel all of a sudden. They are taking oil tankers and back to shore in the Persian Gulf. The security of the Persian Gulf is tied to their security. And they feel like they're rounded upon by everybody else.
How likely is it, Daniel, I've got to ask you this, if this situation escalates, that the Iranians could close or hinder shipping through the Straits of Hormuz, which is, of course, as you know well, the gateway to the Persian Gulf? Iran dominates the northern coast of that gateway into the Persian Gulf. And there have been fears that just as Iranian proxies, Houthis, are making life difficult for shipping going through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal, that Iran itself could do something even more serious in terms of global flows of oil every day, blocking the entire route into and out of the Persian Gulf itself.
Iran could do that, and they have threatened repeatedly over the past few years to do that if they were pushed into a corner. You know, this week they've taken that tanker, which is believed to have been owned by an Israeli company or person.
Yeah, it was attacked by Iranian drones, wasn't it?
And they've done that several times over the past year with many, many different flagged ships. And, you know, their little speedboats going across the Persian Gulf and the Hormuz Strait and all these kind of things is, you know, a bit of a teaser to say that we could do this on a much bigger scale and that, you know, if there's an all-out war. And it is actually a very worrying thing because, as we found out from the Houthis in Yemen, which are obviously, if not, you know, supported by Iran, and I don't think they're directly controlled by them, but they have aligned policies, they can cause absolute havoc across the shipping lanes.
Obviously, you watch the Middle East very closely. You spend a huge amount of time in the Middle East. What do you think is going to happen now with Iranian-Israeli relations in particular as the world watches? As you say, the Iranians have shown if they want to close the Straits of Hormuz, they can. And they've shown with this strike on Israel, do you think that was a warning as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was a test. It was a test run. And you got to see it like that. And I'm sure they see it like that. You know, I'm sure there's intelligence people from many different countries all assessing how effective an Iranian attack on Israel could be. And I'm sure the Israelis are also doing that right now. And the Israeli defense minister recently said that they will respond in kind because it's, you know, they have to do that now because Iran said they had to do that. So we could see this conflagration growing very, very fast. And that's the fear that everybody has, including the Americans and the Brits, who do not want to see this grow any further as quick as it is.
Do you think there's a new world order now, Daniel? And if there is, what role does Iran play in it? And who are Iran's best friends now?
Well, Iran's best friends are the Chinese and the Russians. They see their neighbourhood as their surest fire way to, you know, continue to rule that country and to, you know, have an economy that won't be sanctioned because they can barely do any business with Western countries. Over the next few years, you can imagine that Iran's position is going to remain pretty much eastern looking or, you know, northern looking in the case of Russia, even though, you know, Iran has been banging on for years about how great trade is with the Russians. Recent data from Russia itself said that, you know, they're actually having a decline in trade year on year.
Daniel, suddenly the whole world is focused on Iranian-Israeli relations, Iranian-Western relations for obvious reasons. Iran has this incredible diaspora of which you are part. I mean, so many high-achieving, hugely influential people of Iranian origin living in the UK, living in the US, and I'm sure you're rightly proud of that. But what role can this diaspora play, if any, in helping to at least begin to form some kind of rapprochement here, which so many people in the world are desperate to see.
You see, that's the problem. And, you know, diaspora studies have been quite an interesting thing over the past few years. Iran's diaspora has been, you know, leaving the country for the past 70 years. I mean, my own family started to make the move in the 50s. One of the issues you have is many who left after the revolution, many of which went to Los Angeles and a few went to Paris and London, have a very specific view of the country that was apparent in the 1970s. They have a view of Iran becoming best friends of Israel again, or the US able to change the regime from the inside. It doesn't appear likely. One of the things I always tell people is that when you spend a few years living amongst the locals, as you would say, you find out that their issues are less esoteric than, for example, the ones who live abroad and have a very myopic view of the country from several generations ago. They're more busy with trying to, you know, pay for their car loan or find a visa to leave the place than, you know, trying to tackle the systematic problems of the government.
Do you see any grounds for hope, finally, Daniel?
You know, there's going to be some big changes along the way. Is there going to be a collapse of the Islamic Republic? No, I don't see that, because their infrastructure is strong enough to withstand anything from the outside, although the pool gets smaller as the years go on and many of them fall by the wayside. But, you know, there are some big events coming up. The death at some point in the near future of Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the supreme leader of Iran and he's been there since the 1980s. There are many people vying for that top position. Many people suspect that there might be a complete change in how the government decides to interact with the world. There are comments that, you know, he's the one personally holding off from any relations. Younger revolutionary people in that country have a different view, some a bit more left-wing, some even a bit more hardcore than the revolutionaries of 1979. So it could go one of many ways. But there are so many variables possible in the next few years that you can't predict it as much as, for example, the situation between Israel and Iran. Israel supports the former Shah of Iran's son, Reza Pahlavi. He visited Israel. He talked to Netanyahu. Iran and Israel before the revolution had direct flights. There was an Israeli embassy in Tehran, which was handed over to the Palestinians after the revolution. They look to try and use rose-tinted glasses of the past to attempt to persuade the local population to overthrow the system. Whether that happens or not, I can't predict.
Thanks so much for joining us on Planet Normal.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it, Alison. Daniel Radd is somebody who moves between Iran, the Middle East more broadly, and the West, an extremely knowledgeable journalist. And I thought it was particularly interesting what he was saying about growing cooperation between Iran and China, between Iran and Russia, this kind of new world order.
As you say, it's great to get the perspective of someone who lives on both sides of it. I mean, you've been to Tehran. I haven't. I just think that for me, it's the tragedy of a country where we see the astonishing bravery of young Iranian women who are being whipped, beaten, murdered for wanting to remove their head covering. It is Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, Liam, this Iranian Revolutionary Guard dominating, having a tyrannical grip over a population.
And why does Iran matter, Alison? Not only because of the shocking possibility that conflict between two really powerful countries like Iran and Israel could spill out across the Middle East and even beyond. In the here and now, it matters, even if that doesn't happen, fingers and toes crossed, of course, because this tension bids up oil prices, it bids up energy prices, it bids up inflation. We're seeing that in the numbers now, that geopolitical tension is making it much, much harder for central banks across the West to cut interest rates anytime soon. That's the case in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere. And be in no doubt, if those interest rate cuts are delayed here in Britain, that's seriously going to impact politics. It's going to make it even harder for the Tories to make any kind of attempt to challenge Labour, in my view, at the upcoming general election.
Before we come to our emails, I am nominating Liam Halligan for the next Chancellor of the Exchequer. How we're going to get you into Parliament, God only knows, but we'll manage somehow. Now, on to our listener emails, the messages you send to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We learn so much from them. A flood of reaction to Liz Truss, Liam, very much dividing reaction. Robert says, Truss, Kwarteng were foolhardy and underprepared, but worse, the Bank of England and Treasury were enjoying a snooze fest, oblivious to the LDI disaster hurtling towards them. It's interesting how one gang gets the chop and the other, well, not even a rap across the knuckles. Very well said. And Chris says, where would Thatcher have been without William Whitelaw? Truss needed such a wise owl. Almost all the media club just snigger at her failure. I've yet to hear support of any value from many politicians. In my estimation, Liz is the only Tory with a truly Tory strategy. Sunak is a political non-entity. And Cherry says, Liz Truss, comedy gold. And KK says, bring back the lettuce.
Just before we move on, I should say briefly that LDI investments are liability-driven investments. The basic idea is that they're investments financed and backed by debt. So if the debt becomes more expensive, the investments look a lot less clever and the markets take umbrage. There you go, the LDI investment scandal in less than 30 seconds. This is from Nick, co-pilot. Dear Alison and Liam, I was particularly interested in the interview with Julian Jessop, of course, the excellent economist that we had on Planet Normal last week. It seems that a little mentioned or commented on part of the Alan Bates evidence to the Horizon Post Office inquiry last Tuesday concerned the part played by the civil service advising Lib Dems Ed Davey, Joe Swinson and Norman Lamb. I'm no fan of the Lib Dems, but Mr. Bates clearly stated that he was more annoyed by the negative briefing given to ministers by civil servants. I hold the department and civil servants more to blame in a lot of these instances why things never progressed at the time, because I'm sure them and the post office briefing ministers, they were briefing them in the direction they wanted to brief them in. I'm sure that our lack of progress followed Brexit and in so many other areas of government policy is totally because the blob do not want the government to succeed. So civil servants oppose the direction of travel. It's time to bring these people to account. The UK should introduce the system used in the US. The government must bring in people to be responsible for implementation of policy supported by the lower-graded civil servants. Mandarins have long outlasted their usefulness, says Nick. Best wishes and keep up the good work. I've told so many people about your podcast.
Nick, that is actually, you may be horrified to learn that you're just basically singing from the Liz Truss hymn book. And finally, another Nick. Overjoyed, says Nick. Dear co-pilots, that was my reaction on hearing that Michaela's policy against praying in school had been endorsed in the High Court. But, of course, the next stop will be the Court of Appeal, followed by the Supreme Court. Certainly a time to show solidarity with the great Catherine Burble Singh and her dedicated staff. Frankly, I cannot see that coming from Westminster. Nick says, P.S., much as I admire Claire Fox and appreciate her contribution to the debate, I missed you, Alison. I presumed you were tending the cat. How right you are. How right you are.
And I won't reveal that it's Alison who tends to pick the emails that we've read out, but there you go. And on that bombshell, that's it from Planet Normal for another week. As we leave our sanctuary of sweet reason, our flying refuge of reason views, email of the week, Alison, it's got to be you.
It's going to be to the Nick, not the Nick who was very kind to me, but the Nick who spoke very brilliantly about Julian Jessop and rightly highlighting Alan Bates's very good point about the slothful civil service, which did so much to harm post office employees.
So there you go. If you are that Nick, email us at planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk and put in the subject heading of your email, mug winner, and send us your postal address. And our Planet Normal colleagues will make sure a rare as rocking horse poo Planet Normal mug wings its way to you. And as we speed away from our beloved Planet Normal and the madness of Planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to our producers, Isabel Bajard, Cass Ho and Louisa Wells. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.